position number 22677, wheel 3.
Jefferies, rail 3.
You were saying not compared with the infantry?
Aye, there was not much to do if you compared to the infantry. I mean, you had lots of units to go to there, but in the medium regiment, you had two batteries, and there really wasn't anywhere else to go to apart from them. They all came to us, you see. Anyway, these two batteries, I toddled off one morning to go to them, about 10 o'clock in the morning, going along the road, happy as a little sandboy. The shell lands the road in front of me. Next thing I know, I was being covered in petrol. The tank, the shell... A bit of shrapnel hit the front of the petrol tank, gone into it, you see. A big, oh, I've still got a bit of shrapnel upstairs, big, quite a big chunk, about 2 inches diameter, hole in my petrol tank. All the petrol came out and soaked me. So I got off the bike pretty quick, I can tell you that, and got in the ditch. So I waited to see if the bike went up in flames, and it didn't. So I was really lucky there, the thing didn't catch fire. Anyway, I went down the, there was enough petrol left in the tank to carry on when I got back in the road. Look at this blooming red hole. The other side of the tank was undamaged, so it was about enough for about another 20 miles, I suppose. So I went down to the battery, and I told them to steer clear of me with their cigarette ends and things like that. I didn't want to go up in flames. And I told them what had happened. And they said, oh, yes, what happened? They reckon there was there was a German gun there somewhere, and they couldn't find him because they used smokeless ammunition. They couldn't find where the gun was. But they found where the men lived, where they camped, you see. And they sent me back on my way. I got back, I saw the sergeants in the LAD, that's the Light Aid Detachment of the Rimi, who repaired all the vehicles. And I told him I got a leak in my petrol tank, and he had a look and saw what caused it. And he eventually put a patch over it. But it was just quite a showpiece, that was, for some days. My bike had a big hole in the front of it. Because if it had gone about an inch off, it would hit me there, you see.
On your knee?
Yeah, just about level with my knee, half an inch off. I was pretty clever, pretty lucky there. Yeah, anyway, a few days later they told me that they'd found this, where the cooks, they reckoned it was the cooks having, were allowed a little bash in the morning in between doing the meals, the cooks were allowed to fire a few shots off, you see. So they found this cookhouse, all the Germans queued up for their meals there. So they gave... one shell per gun, 16 4.5-inch shells, at past 7 one morning, lands on the cookhouse. It's a bit funny when you think of it sometimes, isn't it? But unfortunate for the Germans. Just one shell per gun, all at the same time.
So they'd have hit it?
Oh, you reckon so. Yeah. Yeah, well, the next thing, of course, that happened was we moved up the war progress. The ground dried up. You can move again. We moved on in the convoy. And it's not the convoy. Somebody started shelling us. So we jumped out the vehicles and got back of her farmhouse. There's a great big pig slurry thing there. Concrete trench about 3 foot wide, about 6 foot deep. It was half full of pig slurry. I know we stood looking around this thing, it'd be a safe place, and they wouldn't never get killed down there, but you'd never have any friends again. We're full of pig slurry. So we stood looking at this, well, shall we jump in or shan't we? And we didn't, so that was that. But as I say, if there'd been any more shells, we'd have been in there. Oh, yeah. Oh, we carried on. Then, of course, the war was getting towards the end of it. We started moving faster and faster, you know, covering more ground. But the trouble, of course, up there was you've got very big rivers. You've got the River Po and the Isonzo and some other river, very big rivers. I mean, the Po up by the coast there is as big as the Thames in the middle of London. You know, it's quite big. It's come all the way from the Alps, though, from Turin. And we got to the point there where the units were going so fast that we had to touch with each other by radio. We were under the command of the New Zealand Division by that time. And so they sent me down to the New Zealand Div headquarters to be there in case they couldn't get radio communication. They'd rely on me, you see, to go on. So I spent 5 days with the New Zealanders there. It was very interesting.
In what way?
Well, I learned a lot there I don't think anybody else would much know about. Because the New Zealanders were a law of themselves. They were. They were the champion looters, really. They hadn't drawn any pay for 2.5 years. They all knew each other, you see, the New Zealand did. There were about 20,000 blokes, and they all knew each other by name, pretty well, as far as I can make out. I mean, there was no formality there. The major in this section was called Charlie, as I remember about him. I mean, going for the British Army, it was a revelation. There was no comparison at all. I mean, they all got 3 times the amount of pay I did, to start with. The major was a bloke called Charlie. The rest are all friendly, happy blokes, you know, very laid back, as you might say. Not like the Australians at all. These blokes, they didn't. There was no messing with them. They didn't sort of show off anything like that. The quietest lot of chaps you ever come across. But they did. They lived without pay for 2.5 years. They flogged everything they could lay their hands on.
What could they lay their hands on?
Well, this is full of things, isn't it? I mean, they told me that that they came across places on their way. So they went down the south, they found a vermouth factory. So they unloaded their water trucks, all their water containers, loaded up with vermouth. And they lived on vermouth for several days, they reckon. They hadn't got any washing water. So their government had to pay the company 10,000 quid compensation later on for what they'd done there. Then they used to go on. And as one lot were engaged in fighting, you know, pushing forward, with another bunch behind them, taking all the furniture from there and taking it down south to flog it. And they'd come back and share the proceeds amongst themselves. They didn't need money from...
Where did the furniture come from?
The Italians had all run away. The Italians were all scarper, they'd gone elsewhere to avoid the fighting. And these blokes would go in and strip the place of anything worth having and take it away. I don't know, should I be saying all this? Should I get into trouble?
I wouldn't have thought so at this stage.
This is true. I mean, when I was with them, they found a sugar factory because the Itais made sugar from sugar beet. That's where they grew it up that part of the Po Valley. And they got this sugar factory. And they put their MPs on the gate there, stop anybody else getting in. And they got their trucks and loaded up with sugar, refined sugar first of all, then they're selling it to the Italians, you see. When I left them, they gave me half a sack of sugar, but it was molasses more than sugar. It was sort of rough stuff before it'd be fully refined.
So what did you do with it?
Well, I gave it away in the end. I couldn't find anybody to sell it to. Yeah, I didn't want it. I thought it was suspicious they were, the Italians. I didn't have much time to flog it. Because I left them, you see, and they gave me this sack. And it nearly tipped me in the Po. Because across the River Po, there was a pontoon bridge. It's two tracks about 18 inches wide on pontoons. You had to ride across this thing, you see. The other side's a big river, the Po. So I made sure there was nothing in front of me. Because it was going down like that. A truck would go along, push it down, you see, and then you're riding on a wave behind it. If the truck could stop in the middle of the Po, but I couldn't on a motorbike, they would put my feet. I wouldn't have been able to stop once I got going. So they gave me this sugar. I stuck it on the side of the bike. And, of course, it upset the steering. It wobbled, you see, going slow. Now I had to go fast to keep straight. I was so frightened all my life going across this blue great river. Because the bike was starting to wobble, you see. And I was catching up the truck in front of me. I say he could stop it the minute he wanted, but I couldn't. Anyway, I got across there without falling in. And then carried on. Because by that time, the regiment had got up to Trieste, you see. And I was way back, 100 miles away. So I went along, there was no hurry to join them anyway. I had a look at Venice on the way. Called in a rode across the causeway to Venice, had a look round there. Couldn't go anywhere there, of course, it's all water. But I carried on, caught it with a unit. By that time, they were in Yugoslavia. They got out of Italy. Well, it was still Italian territory, I suppose, but in a land where the locals didn't speak Italian. They didn't like us at all, these locals, because we'd been used to friendly sort of Italians who were happy to see us. But this lot weren't.
This was near Trieste?
North of Trieste. Do you know Italian? Well, Trieste is on the coast, you see. And the little strip about 2 miles wide, going back for about 20 miles, which is Italian, which is where they speak Italian. Go inland of that, you find they don't speak Italian at all. It's all, well, I don't know where it is, Croatia, isn't it? Slovenia.
Slovenia,
yeah. Anyway, there was Slovenia they'd got into. Because Marshal Tito When the Germans disappeared, he and his mob had tried to invade Italy. To grab as much of Italy as they possibly could, you see. So they were halfway to Venice by the time we got there. So anyway, when I got to the back of the unit there, they were up in the hills over the overlooking Trieste. And they're training their guns on Tito's headquarters in Trieste, because he was occupying the place. And the New Zealanders were occupying it as well. There were two of them there. Because apparently, as far as I know now, there was never any demarcation line drawn up between the great powers where Italy should be finished and Yugoslavia should start, you see. So it was decided by the locals on the spot after the war finished, really, where the demarcation line should be. That's why now you find the demarcation line follows the ethnic background. The Italians are in the Italian part, and the Yugoslavs, the Slovenians, are in the Slovenian-speaking part. It's divided on ethnic grounds completely. Goes a little narrow strip along the coast. It's all Italian. Yeah, we sat there, and eventually, come May the 2nd, we had a little letter from Alexander telling us the war was over. Order of the day. So we finished 6 days before anybody else, you see. May the 2nd, we finished our war. All the Germans had gone. All the Germans who were there wanted to surrendering to us rather than the Italian partisans, because they were frightened what the Italians might do to them. So the units of the 8th Army, as it was then, the New Zealanders were occupying Trieste, maintaining the peace there. And the 7th, the 8th Div and the 6th Div had gone up into Austria. Because there was nothing to stop them, you see. Well, Germans all gone home. They're rounding up all these weird groups from the German army, the Cossacks and the God knows what they were there. But that's where they round up all these ex-Russians, the white Russians.
Did you see anything of that?
Well, I saw one bloke in a transit camp. He looks like he's wearing his, but the material of his uniform was so thin. It was like, I was in the winter, following winter he was there. I didn't speak to him, but his uniform was so pitiful. You know, he got those like pajama material. I don't know whether this chap had been captured, but he was very sorry for himself.
This was a German uniform?
No, Russian. He was a Russian. I think he was in some sort of Russian unit, because they had a Cossack unit there fighting, as you see. The Cossacks. The Germans recruited them to fight for them against the Russians. Oh, yeah.
Did you see anything of their being sent back to the east?
Oh, no, that was... We'd left there, I think, before that happened. That's where Macmillan was doing it, wasn't it? He signed the agreement with Stalin that all these Russians had served with the Germans should be sent back, and the Yugoslavs as well. Because a lot of Croatians served with the Germans. Yes, they went back to their death. A certain death, they knew that when they were going. But they made sure they went. That was it. Yeah, so we sat outside Trieste for a month or two, and I went off on a 6-month course, something to do. Because I was running building courses, you see, in the local school there. And I went on a clerk of works course. Thought I might learn something. Because I... We were thinking then about what you do when you get home, you see, what sort of job you'd find. I thought I'd go back to our house estates department and become a housing manager or something like that, you see. So I had to learn building construction. And so I went on a 6-month course for that.
Did you find it difficult settling down in civilian life again?
Oh, yeah. Well, I've forgotten there, really, but...
Was this in Birmingham?
Yeah, I went back to Birmingham. Yeah... No, I went back to the estates above. I mean, there were jobs for everybody then. You had no difficulty finding a job. I thought I was well off. I got £6 a week. I thought I was well off. So I found £6 didn't buy very much. So I went across this course. By the time then they started sending us home on leave, you see, because we hadn't been home since 1943. So we went off on leave, a month's leave. And when my turn for that came, of course, I wanted to go, so I didn't finish the course anyway. didn't mean much to me. I got to the point where they were far beyond what I needed to know. So our unit had moved to Trieste, to Turin then. Turin, you know, on the east, on the western side of Italy. They were rounding up, their job there was rounding up all the partisans, getting the arms off them. They used to hide all the stuff the Germans had left behind. They used to hide away, you see. Used to find a tank inside a hayrick and things like that.
Did you do any of that?
No, by the time I got back, they'd finished doing that, but that's what their job had been. In Trieste, a very nice town, Turin. Yeah, lovely little place. We're in some barracks just outside it. A little electric train service into the town itself. Very pleasant, that was. We didn't have anything to do. No work of signals. That's all finished, you see. Because the unit was all together. The regiment was all in one camp. So nothing to do at all. That was rather boring. So I went on leave anyway, came back, and went on a month's course again as a carpentry course. They passed the time away. We went up and they took us out round the Fiat factory. Because the Fiat works did all sorts of things there. They had their own coal mines, their own steel works. They made trains, aeroplanes, cars, trucks, everything. If they ran Turin, 80% of the people in Turin lived or worked for Fiat. They're all connected with it. They ran the town completely. Yeah, I saw television there for the first time, the Italian radio station. Closed circuit television they had there then, 1940, beginning of 46. Yes. Oh, they went behind. They were ahead of us at that time. Yeah. And of course, we went on. And of course, when the Japanese war was over, so there was no more wars to fight, then all the units started reducing in strength. So the 76th Medium combined with the 75th Sister Regiment, who were just outside Milan, and we went off to join them. Spent about a month there. Then, one other thing that New Zealanders were good at selling, was horses. Because the German army, a lot of their transport was horse-drawn. Like all the horses had the big, German army flank, on the flank of the horse, stamped on it, because they burnt, so show where it came from. But the New Zealanders used to round up these horses, because they knew all about farming. They knew all about horses and things like that. Round the horses up, sell them to the Italians, then their MPs would go back and confiscate them, sell them against someone else. A pretty clever lad, you know. A great admiration for them. And they know, you see, the New Zealand government thought they could do no wrong. They didn't, there was no sort of penalty for looting, and the New Zealand army, as far as I know, was the accepted thing. Ah, yes. I nearly joined then.
What do you mean you nearly joined
then? I thought when I leave the army, I'll go and join that lot. But eventually, we went to Milan with the 75th Medium. Then they, in turn, got so reduced, they joined up with the 2nd Medium. We had to go all the way, drove all the way down to Salerno. First time being on a bike for a month, that was. Down to Salerno. Went with them for a month or so. Then they packed up, and I ended up the war in the rear link signals the Polish Corps in Ancona on the eastern side.
What did you make of the Poles?
Oh, the Poles? Well, they started off with one division, as far as I know. They ended up with three. Because anybody who had any connection with Poland, who could speak a few words of Poland, if they were in the German army, then they captured them, they used to interrogate them. Anybody who wanted to join the Polish army, they took him in with open arms. So you ended up the situation where the Poles were speaking German to themselves. I know in the medical centre at Ancona, they go in there, they're all chatting away in German. Then you find that there's a Polish prisoner of war camp. No, a German prisoner of war camp just outside Ancona, and the Poles were guarding it. So you find the blokes inside were the comrades of the ones who were guarding them, been the same unit in the German army. So the one could speak a few words of Polish, the other one couldn't.
How did you get on with the Poles?
Never much to do with them. No, we were just a little unit on our own there, about 40 of us. We never did anything. Used to go walk along the road, pick up the mail every morning, come back, and that was that. There were only two DRs there. I didn't ride them. I had an old bike there, which was unroadworthy. I tried it once. I frightened the life out of me. Poor thing. So I didn't ride a bike again there. No, didn't do much. Just lay on the beach all day. It's the summer of 46. Spent most of the time lying on the beach, Ancona. Very happy way of passing the time, I suppose.
Is that when you were demobbed?
Yeah, in about the August, I came back to this country.
How do you feel now about having served as Don R in the Second World War?
Oh, it's the best job in the army, I think. The only job better than that was the bloke who drove the dentist. Dentist driver, he had a good job, he did.
Why was that so good?
Well, he never got never in any danger, anything like that. Just people around driving a bloke around all from place to place. But we used to get around, you see. You could go out, and once you'd done your job, you came back, and on the way back, you'd see all sorts of things.
You mentioned how the Kiwis didn't seem to have army authority stopping them very much from selling stuff. But was it different in the British Army then?
Very much so. I mean, it was a court-martial offence to loot, looting anything, you see. Two of our chaps were pinched, court-martialed, for looting from a house we had. The doors in the certain rooms were locked, you see. But they got in and sold some of the stuff, and they eventually were caught and had 28 days in the glass house for doing it. Came back like skeletons.
Whereabouts in Italy was that?
Well, south of Florence. Don't they had no name particularly.
Did they tell you what had happened to them in the glass house?
Oh, yes. The vivid description. They were running around all day, everything on the double. Hardly any food. And they were like skeletons, literally. You can see every bone in their body. They swore they'd never go back again.
What type of things had they sold?
I think they were pictures, I don't know, something like that, artifacts of some kind. But of course, in Florence, all the galleries there were empty. So we were told. We got into one once, and they were told that the galleries were empty, they'd all been taken away for safekeeping.
You were telling me earlier about the question of selling petrol in the war, army petrol.
Ah, yeah, well, I say petrol, of course, during the war, some of the chaps had relatives who were in the Merchant Navy, and they'd rather offended them to think anybody would sell petrol there, those who risked their lives bringing to us. So they didn't do it. But I never saw petrol ever being sold during the war, but after the war was over, of course, it was open field then. You had no record of what you'd bought, what you'd taken in, you didn't start with. The chap in the armoured car had 20-gallon petrol tanks on his thing, and he was a millionaire, I think. He used to fill it up, take it outside, flog it, and go and get some more. And the MPs were doing the same thing.
Where was that?
In Turin. Of course, there were only a few of us in Turin at the time. 600 men in the whole of Turin, a city of 500,000.
Do you think the MPs really were doing it?
Oh, yes. Anybody was doing it. Anybody could, if you wanted money. There were plenty of ways of making money in Italy during the war, when the war was finished. I mean, you see, a pound note was the pound officially was worth 400 lira. But you could get 1,000 lira for a pound note, if you could find one, if you could get one. So I brought some back with me from leave when I came back. About 20 pounds, doubled 2.5 times their face value, you see. I mean, the official rate was ridiculous, really. It was far too low. But that's what they used to pay us. So, of course, you didn't rely on your army pay.
So you didn't draw the pay?
Oh, it drew the pay, yeah, but I mean, you didn't rely on it. It just wasn't essential. They had a parade one day when you were in Turin and made the blokes turn out their wallets because, of course, they shouldn't have had anything more than the official army, the Allied military notes, you see. And of course, if you found a bloke with a 10,000 lira wallet in his pocket, he must have sold something to get it. I think I wasn't there at the time, but they made turn all their money out.
Did they confiscate it?
I don't know. I think they must have done. I don't see what else they could do. I don't know what they did with the money, though. The bloke in charge of the stores there never had any spare kit. Everything had been sold. All the blankets had gone, you see. But you see, a blanket makes a very nice coat. When I was in Sicily, in the convalescent camp, the thing there was you had three blankets when you went in. You had to have three when you left. that if you cut one in half, one blanket in half, sold another one, you then had two halves that you could pad out, look like a blanket. So he handed two halves, the full one in, and sold one as well. Pretty base lot.
Do you have any memories of anybody deserting in either Italy or North Africa?
Well, none of our chaps did, because it wasn't worthwhile. But in North Africa, in Tunis one day, he went out to Tunis, the little chap I was with decided he wanted to go back home, so he'd been in the Merchant Navy. So he climbed the locked gates in Tunis, about 12 feet high, went inside them, and he met some of his old friends there. So he decided to stay on board the ship. So when I missed the truck going back to the unit, when I picked up the next day, they wanted to know where I'd been, and I told them. Then the officer wanted to know where this chap had gone to, and I told him. Perhaps I shouldn't have done, really, but he was picked up in Algiers on the way back home. The only deserter I ever met. But I heard of other ones, like in Florence, one of our chaps got picked up for having his jeep pinched. He had to be court-martialed. And while he was waiting for to be done, he was with a bunch of deserters there, and they'd been threatened with court-martial, either the court-martial itself, or going back to their unit for treatment in their own regiment. But one night they decided to get out again, so they knocked the wall down of the place they were in and walked out. And he stayed behind, of course, he hadn't got anything to worry about. He only lost the jeep. But we also heard of one unit there who had made their own number, camouflaged themselves as an RASC unit, had formed a complete unit, complete with some of their made officers, NCOs and so on, and they were employed in running black market goods, providing transport, running a transport organisation. They used to go and draw their petrol and food from the RASC, you see, with quote their number. Eventually the MPs caught on to them in the end and rounded them all up. But they were doing very well. There was about 100 of them altogether.
Did it surprise you that people should desert?
No. I mean, you see, the infantry particularly, they get so fed up with the life after a couple of years they've had it. I mean, they get battle weary. They decide there wasn't no point in carrying on like that. If they're going to die, they might as well die in comfort rather than be shot.
Did it surprise you that the deserters were able to keep out of the clutches of the MPs for so long?
Well, there were so many of them. They reckoned there were more deserters than there were on the front in some cases.
In Italy?
Yeah. I mean, lots of them went, you see. Particularly, they stayed with families. Lived with families on the land very often. No, there's no... I'm afraid the spirit of the war went. Once they landed in Normandy, we knew we were going nowhere anyway. We couldn't get to Germany, not over the Alps. So they decided we were back, we were sort of forgotten altogether, you see.
Were there any songs that you sang in Italy?
Lily Marlene.
Did you ever sing D-Day Dodgers?
Well, that is Lily Marlene. That's the tune. Oh, we have various words made up, but the one you hear now is a sort of sanitized version.
You wouldn't like to sing the original?
I don't remember it now. I've got the words in Italian of it, which a little boy wrote out for me. He knew we'd like this song. He wrote out the words of the Italian version of Lily Marlene for us. I've still got them somewhere. But I can't speak English or Italian.
Could the signal section you were working with ever use their skills to pick up local radio stations?
Oh, yeah, Anzio. They made radios like a crystal set with a razor blade. Razor blade, headphone, and a steel helmet. You could hear quite clearly, because Radio Rome used to have the announcer's Rosa, I think it was. She used to tell us the names of the prisoners who'd been captured the night before. Messages from the ones who'd been captured the night before to their fellows, telling them to come and join them. You know how nice it was.
Did it have any effect?
Well, I've no idea. I shouldn't think so. But they used to play Lily Marlene to us, and of course the German soldiers used to sing it when they were in prisoner of war camps. Used to hear them.